Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC. You're with the BBC, also podcasting via bbcworldservice.com. And this is our technology programme, Digital Planet. Hello, I'm Gareth Mitchell in a studio located at exactly north 51 degrees 30.753, west 0 degrees 07.052. So, why the GPS coordinates? Well, they set the theme for this special edition devoted to location as we look at the web tools and gadgets that are all about where you are. Coming up, Google's plans to make sure we never get lost.
That's Google's mission, right? To organise the world's information. And it never said it's the web information, it's the world's information, so that's part of the world. So I guess that's pretty much answers it.
So will it all save us from losing our way or even losing our relationships, or is it all just a bit scary? Also this week, grab your GPS unit and come on an adventure as treasure hunts take a 21st century turn.
There's a great big log here. Is it under this log?
Well, I don't know. This is where you really have to use it.
2 metres long.
This is your first hunt. Go find.
So find out whether I located the loot and stay with us for much more on this special edition of Digital Planet from the BBC. So our theme is location, and that means we're going to be exploring the geo-web, or geographic web. We've navigated our way to several experts on the subject for this programme, so let's see how some of them might define the geo-web. Jill Clough is a PhD student researching the area at the UK's Open University. In just a few words, here's her definition.
To me, the geographic web is a crossover between the virtual and the physical world. People have access to incredible technologies, mobile technologies, location-aware technologies, social technologies, and they're using them to connect not only with other people but with locations.
Well, we'll have more from Jill later on. We have two more experts for you now, though. First, Mike Jackson of Nottingham University in England, and also Bill Thompson, who's here every week, actually, who gives us his expert comment on Digital Planet. The programme used to be called Go Digital. A bit of a slip there. Bill Thompson, rescue me here. Do you have an off-the-shelf definition of the geo-web?
See, I'll drag you back into the present.
Thank goodness.
It's OK. For me, the geo-web's about adding geographical coordinates to, if you like, the cyber spatial ones that we have in the URL and web addresses and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's about this linkage between geography and what we can do online.
All right, so Mike Jackson on the line from Nottingham. It's always awful going last here. Is there any kind of definition of GeoWeb left that you can give us?
Well, I think, as already said, it's a combination of geography or location-based information and the internet. But the GeoWeb is not just a static situation. It's very much a mobile web as well. And it's not just where things are, it's how to get to it, who else might be there, what else might be there as well, and how you can get there.
So, Mike, are we talking here about, you know, these websites these days? Quite often you go to a website and it seems to know where you are. So when you ask, say, for a cinema listing, it gives you cinemas in your local area.
That's exactly right. And sometimes the accuracy of its guess or of where you are is quite poor at the moment. But with the improvement in technologies, the technology will know more and more accurately precisely where you are. And given that information, of course, the information that it searches from the web can be so much more specific and relevant to you.
And I'm sure, Bill, that's very important. The web seems to become pretty good at telling us what we need to know in terms of maybe who we are, and it's learning to tell us information according to where we are.
You might like websites tell you who you are, Gareth. I prefer to do it.
I think I need that today, but fair enough.
But in terms of where you are, I think what's happened is a lot of older technologies have matured. So although we all know about GPS, geographical positioning system, and that's built into many devices and stuff like that, these days it's possible for a device connected to the internet to get a pretty good idea of its location just by looking at wireless network signals. It's also possible for mobile phones to look at the strength of the signals they have with various base stations and stuff. So more and more of the hardware that we carry around with us or we have access to every day knows where it is, and we can get that information out of it and use it in various ways.
And Mike, I gather you've found this kind of information very useful, just navigating your way to the BBC studio from where you're talking to us now.
Well, exactly. Before I came here, not knowing where the Nottingham studio was, I just quickly went into, in this case, the Microsoft website and was able to print out not just a map, but a very high resolution, three-dimensional image of the very building where I'm being talking to you at this moment.
And Bill?
I know where Bush House is, fortunately, but what I do tend to do these days is I will check in. I will let other people see my location, because it's one thing to use the information for yourself, you know, where am I, how do I get somewhere? What you can also do online now, particularly with sort of various online communities, is say, OK, this is where I am, yeah, which of my friends are in the vicinity, what else is in the area, and just, yeah, track me, yeah, let people know where I am, and then they can respond appropriately, you know, suggest a cup of coffee or shout at me across the street, those sort of things.
Yes, I mean, there's one that you and I both use called Brightkite. There are plenty of others. There's another, not quite the same, but kind of similar one called Doppler. But also, Mike, thinking about mobile devices as well, it just seems that the GeoWeb isn't just about sitting at your computer looking at the internet anymore.
No. As you go around, the device, if you like, tracks your position and interacts with the information on the web. So it can tell you if you're coming to an interesting site, give you details on what might be contained within a particular building, can tell you the history, perhaps, of a historical site that you're standing next to. So it becomes your personalised information portal as you move through space.
Indeed. Well, Mike, speaking of geo services, you know, both on our computers, but you know, on our mobile handsets in this context, Google is adapting its own web-based mapping application to cell phones and other portable devices. It goes hand in hand set with the company's new mobile operating system. The OS, by the way, is the software like, for instance, Windows Mobile or Symbian that all the other applications on your mobile sit on in order to work. The Google mobile operating system is called Android, and Marcelo Quintela at the firm's Brazilian HQ in the city of Belo Horizonte really has his work mapped out for him, because as product manager for Geo for the region, it's his job to bring mapping and related apps to the whole of South America. So on an Android-powered handset, he walked me through some of his latest Geo features.
So what we have here is Google Maps for mobile, which works for the Android, but it also works in BlackBerry, works in different platforms, the iPhone and everything. And one of the coolest things for me is, well, probably the most immediate useful thing for me is that it's able to pinpoint your location on a map, even if you don't have a GPS device. It gives you an approximate location in a map, which has been saving my life in Belo Horizonte, as I said.
Well, and it triangulates from the cell network,
from
does it?
From the cell networks, yeah. So it knows which, where you are in the cell network, so it's able to give you a range of where you are in the map. And the other thing is, if you are in cities that have Street View, that I showed you earlier in the web application, you are able to see Street View in your phone. So you can imagine that if you are at the location that you searched for and you open Street View in your phone, you can look at the streets how they are supposed to look like, and you can check if you're in the right location or not in a map.
I mean, that's insane. You've got it up on your mobile phone here. So we're in Street View. This is basically a 360-degree photo of an area. In this case, it's in California somewhere. And as you turn the phone round, the accelerometer in the phone knows the orientation of the phone and adjusts the image accordingly.
Yeah, so there is a compass that adjusts north, south, east and west, and there's the accelerometer that also tilts vertically the image. So you can, as you look up to the building, the image also shows up.
Yeah, and this is as if we're standing in front of a really tall building in this Californian city, and as you crane your neck up, or in this case, as you move your phone, the view of the building tilts up as well. And so we're going from ground level, and you've just tilted it, and now we can see the top of this tall building.
And if you are in a device that happens to not have the accelerometer or the compass, you can still use either your finger or a joystick. It depends on the device implementation. In this Android device, we do have the feature, so you can use accelerometer and compass.
Otherwise, you can just do it by touching the screen or using the controls on the phone.
Exactly.
Is there a bigger game plan here? Some big ambitious idea of making sure that none of us ever get lost ever again?
Well, that's Google's mission, right? To organize the world's information. And it never said it's the web information, it's the world's information, so that's part of the world. So I guess that's pretty much answers it.
Marcelo Quintela there at Google in Brazil. So, Bill Thompson, as we were hearing, Google aims to organise the world's information, which seems to include geographical information, which is great, but is it also a bit scary?
It is a bit, and I think we ought to make it clear that other large multinational corporations seeking to have ownership of all the world's information do exist, and you know, they may be your choice as well, that Google are not the only people in this sphere, but they have large amounts of money to spend, and they're spending it on doing lots of mapping, on building applications and services like Google Earth and Google Maps that make use of that information. One aspect of it that concerns me slightly is that this is being done by, you know, a private company to serve its purposes. And as long as they overlap with the purposes of all their users, that's fine. But really, you know, Google has this data and it can do what it wants to. It's not constrained in many ways. If they wanted to change the way that programs interact, if they want to change the data they're serving, if they want to start charging for some parts of it, there's basically very little that we could do about it. And fortunately, there are large numbers of people who are working on standards for geographical data, for all of this sort of stuff, and it's to be hoped that the standardization process results in open standards for all of this work. And one aspect in particular, something called the Application Program Interface, the API. APIs are the key to the modern world. They're the way that your program can talk to someone else's program or someone else's data. And as long as Google opens up its sources properly, you won't be reliant on Google applications on a Google Android handset to talk to it. You'll be able to use other software, and other people will be able to add and subtract. And I think that is really important. So we should be impressed by what they're doing, but not see this as being the only way it goes forward.
Sure. And that point about open standards, I suppose, just very quickly on this, it just means basically for us as users, if people are able to build devices and useful little widgets that make our lives better using these applications, then that's good for us as consumers.
It is, and not have the rules changed without you being consulted, not have stuff changed without you knowing.
Right, OK. Yeah, otherwise the system works 1 minute and then stops working the next, which would be a bit bad. All right, Bill, thank you very much for that. Well, if you're lost in the airwaves and really wondering where you are, then worry not. We can indeed locate you. This is Digital Planet from the BBC World Service in London, and you're listening to a special edition on the latest in geo-based technology, how our gadgets behave according to where we are, and websites that determine our position and tell us what they think we need to know based on that. The waypoint you've now arrived at is the halfway point of the show. And in a moment, we bring you travel bugs. But these ones are nicer and much more fun than travel bugs in the tourist tummy upset sense. So leading into all that, let's seek out Jill Clough again at the Open University. We met her at the top of this programme. She's doing a PhD in a phenomenon called geocaching. It's a contemporary technological twist on the age-old pastime of treasure hunts, where players swap compasses and cryptic notes pinned to trees for GPS devices and geo-enabled mobile phones to track down hidden treasure. Although here the treasure is called a cache, hence the term geocaching. Well, Jill's interested in the learning and community-building opportunities that come from bringing together the online and the physical worlds. So the other day, I joined her on campus at the OU for a geocaching venture of our own.
Okay, so we've moved outside of the building. It's a pretty cold, bracing, windy, but thankfully not rainy winter's day here on the campus of the Open University. And we've printed off the details of where we need to go, but also you're setting up your GPS there as well, aren't you?
That's right. I'm just letting it acquire our location, and then what I'll do is I'll get up the details of the cache we're looking for and find which direction we need to walk.
Right, so we're moving a little bit off campus now. We're walking across a bridge over a little stream and down at a footpath. It's a lovely part of the world, actually. We have fields now on each side of us, a very swollen river on my right-hand side.
The river is running quite high because we've had quite a bit of rain lately. And I've got access to the description on my iPod of the geocache we're looking for. And previous people who found it have said it's underwater sometimes, so there is the chance that we might not be able to find it if the river is high. But the last person who found it was on the 18th of January, and it was okay then.
I should have brought my wetsuit, just in case.
Yes. But mine's now giving me a distance of 0.21 miles.
0.21 miles. But already, I'm getting an idea of what geocaching's all about. I mean, we're going on a fairly short geocache here, but walking along with my GPS, and I have a bearing that tells me, you know, basically where I need to kind of, what direction I need to walk in, and an estimated distance, the destination. And there is this wonderful feeling, Jill, of anticipation. I'm already looking around the landscape here, just wondering where this little box of treasures might be. It's fantastic.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've done a certain amount of research on geocaches and why people go geocaching, and the excitement, the challenge and the adventure figure quite highly as motivations alongside getting outside and getting fitter.
Well, exactly, because my usual experiences with GPS are those rather frustrating ones where you've programmed it in the car and you're trying to find a shopping centre or somebody's house, and that, even these days, I mean, it just seems a bit mundane. There's a real sense of discovery and adventure here, and I'm really enjoying it. The heading on this GPS is really saying that we're heading straight at it. It's veering a bit off to the right.
Getting a little bit wet underfoot here.
Those of you at home can hear a squelching sound. That's our feet in all this mud. I'm getting 50 seconds to destination now.
Mine's dropping rapidly to sort of 200 feet. From my past experience of geocaches, this is the point at which we need to slow down and just keep our eyes open for a suspicious-looking pile of sticks, a log, a tree trunk. I mean, we're surrounded by trees and bushes.
Ah, so this is where we go from the technology side of things to the good old-fashioned using our eyes and our instincts.
It's around here somewhere. Oh, it's starting to swing off to the right.
Ooh.
How about yours?
On the right-hand side. Yeah, mine is too. And it says that we are 3 seconds away from it.
Right, well then...
There's a great big log here. Is it under this log?
Well, I don't know.
It's
this
huge,
is where you
log.
Really have to use
it. 2 metres long.
This is your first hunt. Go find.
Oh, I do like a challenge. All right. Okay, so I go in and look at this pile of sticks. I mean, you have to kind of fumble through the undergrowth a bit here to get it. Got all kinds of twigs and things in my hair now. I just know we're homing in on it. My GPS unit is now saying we're 1 second away. So it's obviously very close. And I'm just looking at... I'm sure it's at the base of a tree here. And, oh, hang on. Hello, I think I found it. Fantastic. We're just at the base of this tree, and there's a bit of an old root that I'm going
to... Oh, that looked like it was attached to the tree.
Wow, it's very well hidden, you know. I barely found that. It's in a, you know, like a camouflaged sack almost, and it's the size of a lunchbox. I think they actually have used a lunchbox for this, so I'm just unwrapping it. Look, my first geocache. Can we open it up?
Yes,
okay?
I mean, you're a geocacher now.
This is all part of geocache etiquette. Just open the box. Let's have a look at what's inside. Okay, there's a note. Oh, actually, there is a thing here saying geocaching trail etiquette. So there is an etiquette around geocaching.
There is, and it's on that booklet. Is that the log book? Because to log it on the website, you have to sign a little log book.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay, if we open this log book.
And you can see what people
have... Yeah, for instance, you've got 19th of May. This is all, you know, there's nothing high-tech here. People just writing in pen into this log book. Found by Kitey. Great spot. And, you know, people are leaving little comments. There's lots of little kind of smiley faces and stuff. So I'll fill that in a minute. But let's see what else is in here. There's some playing cards. Somebody's business card. And then there's, like, some instructions. But then, yeah, all this other cool stuff as well. Like a little highlighter pen. Nice little necklace there as well. Very shiny. A whistle. There you go. Just to prove that exists. And bits and pieces. Okay.
And...
We'll sign the log, and that's it. Right, so going through the logbook here, there's it seems a lot of people who do this are called TB for some reason. Is that Tony Blair? Is he a big geocacher? I don't know. What does that mean?
I don't know. He could be. No, TB stands for travel bug, and it's a particular type of token that you can leave in a geocache, and it has its own web page. Geocaches buy a little tag, and the tag has a unique number on it that is linked to the web page. You set it up and then you release it, and you leave it in a cache. Somebody else comes along, they take it, and if they can move it along on its journey, they put it in another cache about 2 weeks later, and you can track them using Google Maps and see how far they've travelled. And lots of schools use these as an educational aid.
What kind of adventures would these travel bugs have?
Well, in a school in the United States of America, they released a travel bug, and its goal was to be around the neck of the lead husky in the Cross Alaska sled race. Geocachers were really enthralled by this, so they would pick it up and they moved it across the America, and it actually made it there on time and was around the neck of the lead husky.
And in fact, we've sent our reporter, Beth Rose, to the west of England to find out a bit more about these travel bugs.
Well, I'm at the top of a very windy Dartmoor today with a class 4 from Landscove Primary School, and they're just about to set their travel bugs off on a very long journey to a school in Nepal. But first, we've got to find the right coordinates to place the King, Queen and Prince of Landscove to start their journey.
I'll show you what we're looking for. At the moment, Anna's winding up the GPS things so we can work out where we really are. On the map, we are down here.
Yeah, so we've got to go all the way.
We've got to go all the way across the heath. But on the way there, I want to see if we can find that. There's a rock with the Battle of Bovey Heath written on it with some information. And if we can find that, then we can definitely position ourselves.
Cool. Okay.
Where are they? Oh, they're at the top. Right, well, we've just walked all the way down a really steep hill, and now we're sloshing through puddles, trying to get back up to the top of the hill.
Okay, guys, we are now close to this geocache. Okay. It is somewhere near to us. We are looking for a 3-litre Tupperware container. And when it was put here in the first place, it contained a Nemo inflatable swimming ring.
Cool.
A screwdriver set, a UV pen and reader, and a thing called a logbook. Now, we will find it at the base of a battle-scarred tree. So let's get busy looking, shall we?
Come on!
Hi, Paula, it's me again. I've got great news. We found the box and we managed to put our stuff in.
Hip, hip, hooray!
Hip, hip,
hooray! Hip, hip, hooray!
And with the head teacher, Robin Smith, Meg, from Class 4, has somehow managed to find the ice cream box under a lot of trees and growth, but she's found it. So now we've got the box, what do we do next?
Okay, we're going to have a look in the box, and we are going to put our people, the King of Landscove, the Queen of Landscove and the Crown Prince of Landscove, into the box and then kiss them goodbye on their epic journey all the way to Kathmandu. And then we'll just hope for the best. Pop them in.
We sure.
Can someone describe what the King of Landscove looks like?
Well, he's got like a purple cape on because he's the King of Landscove, and he's got like his... And this down here, it's got a kind of code for like if anyone finds it and takes it, and they dial that number, and then they can kind of take it to like the London if they're going there or something like that.
And what's his ultimate destination? Where does he want to end up?
Kathmandu's a long, long way. Yeah.
I'm with Kira. We've just finished our geocaching adventure. Did you happen to like it this afternoon?
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was like a secret treasure hunt.
Now, these bugs are going all the way to Nepal, which is a very long way away. Have you got any estimations to how long you think it might take?
About 6 months, 7 months, something like that.
And whose travel bug do you think will get to the destination first? Landscove will receive the Nepalese school's travel bug, or will they get yours first?
I think we're going to get there first.
Yeah, plenty of competition going on there, and those travel bug people were talking to Beth Rose, and they were over in the west of England. Of course, earlier on, I was on the campus of the Open University, also in England, with Jill Clough. So, Bill Thompson, do you like this idea of, you know, sending travel bugs off to Nepal and sending Gareth Mitchell's off to go and find things in boxes on university campuses?
Well, tramping around damp fields looking for sandwich boxes doesn't actually appeal to me very much, I have to confess.
Oh, yeah, should have
rather
been
you
there,
were
Bill.
Doing that.
It
but the travel bugs, I think, are a really good way to get particularly school kids thinking about, you know, the geographical web, thinking about how the technology is used, and also just getting a sense of the world. So I think that's a really nice way of using it.
All right. Well, Mike Jackson, I should say, from the University of Nottingham, joining us from our Nottingham studio. Mike, is your research kind of sort of quite similar to this? You know, the idea of, I suppose in this case, exploiting through play almost the mobile web and the geographic web.
I think that's exactly the case. I think the GeoWeb is a fun technology, and location-based gaming is a great way to explore very important technology development capabilities, but in a fun way. And it opens up the door to mass consumer applications such as gaming, but also very serious business and government applications as well.
And you mentioned, you know, the serious side of things as well, and I wanted to get onto that, and you know, specifically privacy, because you know I can't help worrying that, you know, if my computer, you know, knows where I am, and even my mobile phone handset knows where I am, that means, you know, big business potentially knows where I am, or, you know, maybe oppressive regimes or what have you. Is that a concern you have as you go about your own research in the geographic web?
I think it's definitely an issue, but one needs to put into context the precision with which the positioning can happen. If you're using the telecommunications network to position your device, then that's accurate really typically to 50 and less meter accuracy. On the other hand, if you're using GPS technology, then yes, the device can be positioned very accurately, but that information is only available to you on your phone unless you decide to disclose that to other people. And then, of course, it can be used for commercial purposes, so that as you approach, let's say, a McDonald's restaurant, it can send you perhaps a spam message which says 10% off your burger if you buy in the next 10 minutes.
Well, that sounds terrible, though. You know, just advertising that's so kind of clever, it even knows where you are and tailors its ads accordingly. It sounds awful.
But only if you allow it. So you have the choice.
Mm, you can switch that off. Just a quick thought from you, Mike, though. I mean, you must get asked this all the time, but what about GPS? We know we're told this is a kind of an American defence system that's been opened up for civilians, but they could turn it off at any moment, couldn't they? Is that a concern?
I think the likelihood of it being turned off now is extremely remote, both from the assurances the US government have given, but also because of the huge range of commercial, business and security-based applications which depend on it. But having said that, of course, the European community have decided to create a European capability as well, and the programme known as Galileo is now underway to create a European equivalent of the GPS series of satellites to give positioning to the general public.
OK, well, with a view to the future there, Mike, thanks very much for that. It's Mike Jackson from Nottingham University. Thanks also to Bill Thompson. This edition of Digital Planet was produced in association with the Open University. You can get more information from bbc.co.uk/worldservice. The producer's Pam Rutherford. I'm Gareth Mitchell.